customers have depended on our fast turnaround and superior quality product for almost 20 years, and so will you. Please call us at 831-373-0493 or visit our website at www.duplicationconnection.com.
The doomsday clock was moved 2 minutes closer to apocalyptic midnight this morning, the first change since 2002. Scientists say global warming and genetic engineering of diseases convinced them to move the second hand closer to worldwide destruction. Cancer deaths in the U.S. have declined for the second straight year. Authorities say fewer people are smoking and techniques for early detection and effective treatment have improved. Marine biologists successfully shepherded to safety 9 dolphins trapped for a week in a shallow cove near Long Island. Today they'll attempt to rescue the 3 remaining mammals. The biologists were afraid the waters would freeze, killing the dolphins. For the first time, a commercial jet is flying equipped with an anti-missile system designed to thwart attacks of shoulder-fired missiles during takeoffs and landings. The MD-10 FedEx flight yesterday marked the start of a series of tests of the laser system designed by Northrop Grumman. Sony Ericsson said today its quarterly net profit more than tripled. The mobile phone maker's $579 million net profit was earned by record sales of its music and camera handsets. Digital music accounted for 10% of all music sales in 2006, $2 billion, double what it did a year before. The International Music Trade Group predicts digital sales will account for 25% within 3 years. Taking a look at Wall Street, the Dow Jones is up 24 points, the NASDAQ is down 4 points, and the S&P 500 is up 3 points. There's more on our website at qualitynewsnetwork.com. I'm Christine Kendall.
And now, from Washington, the Inside Scoop, all the news the government does not want you to hear. Now, here's your host on the Inside Scoop, Mark Levine.
Good afternoon, America, and welcome to the Inside Scoop. The Democrats are off and running. They've only been in control of Congress for 2 weeks, and already the House Democrats have fulfilled 6 of the 8 major bills that they promised they would pass in their first 100 legislative hours. These bills are supporting things that, well, the great majority of Americans support, but the Republican Congress kept bottled up for many, many years. They don't seem to be that extraordinary. Things like banning lobbyist gifts and travel, ending those secret earmarks, requiring pay-as-you-go legislation, which simply means no more huge government deficits. Republicans were big on spending money we didn't have, on cutting taxes we needed, on passing on huge debt to our children. The Democrats say, you want to cut taxes? You want to do spending? You got to pay for it. Stop putting our kids in debt. Raising the minimum wage, which hasn't been raised in a decade. Implementing the 9/11 Commission recommendations on Homeland Security, which you would think from a bipartisan commission, Homeland Security, the Republicans would have put in place years ago. But they've already done all of this, as well as promoting stem cell research, including embryonic stem cell research, which can save lives. All of these things that they've done already, just around the corner are 2 more very important bills. Actually, they've done one more thing. I have already done the Medicare prescription drug program. They fixed it, requiring the government to negotiate better drug prices with pharmaceutical companies. That's all done as well. What's left? 2 more things. Cutting interest rates for student loans in half, and energizing America by achieving energy independence, rolling back those huge subsidies to big oil. It's interesting, in this agenda, many Republicans, who of course have fiercely fought this agenda for many years, are now jumping on board. Each of these provisions was passed with some Republican help, everywhere from at least 20% to sometimes 40% with the minimum wage, with the lobbyist ethics. We had every single Republican except one voting for the bill. But some still call the agenda extreme. Some still appear regularly on right-wing talk radio and argue the Democrats have gone too far. And one of those people is my guest today. His name is John Cox. He's the former chair of the Republican Party in Cook County, Illinois. That's the county that includes Chicago. And we welcome him here to the Inside Scoop. John, welcome.
Great to be with you, Mark, I think.
Good to have you. We're going to have a strong debate here.
All I've done is appear on right-wing radio, which is actually not true. I've been on a lot of radio and TV all around the country, and a lot of it, I've been on Air America.
Oh, good for you. I'm glad to hear that you've been on all sides.
At all sides, because we got to get away from calling people right wing and left wing. What we got to do is we got to start looking for solutions, Mark. And
I agree.
What doing in this, and you just ran through a whole list of things that you think are solutions, and the Democrats will try to tell you our solutions. But I'll hopefully get a chance with you today to demonstrate that a lot of those things that the Democrats are doing are counterproductive. Hard for you to believe on that, but
Tell you what, we're going to go through them one by one, I promise. But before we get to them one by one, let me just ask you, overall, you've called this agenda extreme. Now, and we'll get to them specific one by one, but these are things that the great majority of the American people support. Every single one of these has not just 50%, but usually 60, 70% of the American people in support. On each one of these, a decent number of Republicans, ranging from 25% to the ethics bill virtually unanimously, have come around and supported it. Why do you consider overall this agenda to be extreme?
Well, there's certainly the ethics thing was almost like saying, do you agree that going to school is a good thing? You know, it wasn't a very tough vote to say that we should clamp down on lobbyists. A tougher vote would be the one that Harry Reid didn't like, and that was the idea that we're going to actually clamp down on lobbyists' children, that and the children of legislators who act as lobbyists. Harry Reid has five children, no less than five children who are in the lobbying profession. That's wrong. That's a conflict of
interest. Here's what strikes me, John. I mean, you say it was really easy to pass this bill that's just like going to school, but the Republicans had many, many years to pass this legislation. In fact, since the Abramoff scandal, they had at least a year or two, and they didn't pass anything. And now it's interesting.
Mark,
now you're saying it should be stronger than the Democrats have done?
Mark. I'm not going to sit here and defend the Republican Congress. One of the reasons I'm running for president is because I believe that the last Republican Congress didn't act like a Republican Congress. It acted like a lot of Democrats have done over the years, or a lot of career politicians, I should say, have done over the years. And that's what I'm running on. I'm not running in praise of the last Republican Congress. I think
fair enough. Okay, I like this. We both agree that the last Republican Congress was one of the worst Congresses in recent American history. Is that fair?
That doesn't make these ideas that are being passed now brilliant either. You know, the two don't have a connection. You understand?
Oh, I do. No, I just want to establish that we both agree that the last Congress was a really, really awful Congress. They did a lot of bad things, and they should be fixed.
They weren't all that atypical, unfortunately. There's been a lot of Congresses over the years that have done some really bad and stupid things. I could go back to the windfall profits tax in the 70s that Jimmy Carter signed, but that a Democratic Congress passed. So there's a lot of Congresses that have done some really dumb things over
the years. True. And listen, we can all disagree or agree with certain bills passed by Congress, but this Congress, interestingly, was not just not, you know, working. I mean, of course, they worked less than the do-nothing Congress of Harry Truman. But they were actively corrupt. They were actually grabbing money and sticking it in their own pockets. And that's something I think that's even – I mean, you can agree or disagree with any particular bill, but I think we can all agree as Americans, you shouldn't be bribed by lobbyists and putting money in your pocket.
I think we ought to elect people who can't be bought. And that goes for Democrats and Republicans.
Absolutely, which is why I was very glad Pelosi gave no credence to Jefferson down in Louisiana. She kicked him off all the committees, and it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, well, tell that to the Congressional Black Caucus, which gave Jefferson a standing ovation when he got back to Washington. But that's a different story.
I will. I disagree with them.
Yeah.
And I disagree with the voters that elected him. But I do think that the leadership of the House was absolutely right in denying him any access to committees. I mean, it's very interesting when you compare that to someone like Tom DeLay, who, of course, was indicted. William Jefferson has not yet been indicted, although I expect him to be. And even though he was indicted, the Republicans were busy changing their rules to allow him to continue to be not just on committees, but leading the Republican Party. So I'm really glad that Pelosi's taken a much stronger stand than the last Congress.
Well, I think she better. And you know what? I think this is all part and parcel, though, because don't forget, this has been going on in Washington for a long time. I think the public is disgusted in many ways with career politicians of both parties. They're disgusted with the ballooning deficits and the debt. And again, before you rip into the Republican Congress, which of course I'm not going to defend, they spent money like water. for a
drunken
lot of
sailors.
Years, the Congress was in Democratic hands, and it spent money like water, too. So I think we've got to get to a point here where we get to statesmen who get elected to office, not career politicians, not people who are looking to make money, not people who are looking for a career for themselves or their children or their spouses or their friends or their cronies. We all ought to be interested in the solutions that help this country get better.
Well, no one can disagree with that, but I want to get to the specifics. And when we come back, I want to talk with one of the things you just mentioned, which was ballooning deficits. One of the first eight things the Democrats promised to do in their first 100 hours, and in fact they've already done it, is commit to pay-as-you-go spending,
right,
to say, in effect, that you can't pay any more for any spending unless you got the money to pay for it. It was passed 280 to 152. About one quarter of the Republicans broke ranks. Three quarters of them still believed in massive deficit spending. I'm going to get John's view on that, and I want to get your view on that right after the break. Folks, the toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. We'll be right back after this.
The United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights are problem solvers. They accept any challenge and approach every project with the highest of competency and training. UBC has thousands of professionals who can be at your service, giving you the best in business anytime and every time. It's their job to provide manpower. They build partnerships based on respect and trust. They provide skilled, responsible millwrights and carpenters to meet the challenge of any project because they believe and what they're doing and are so very committed to getting each and every job done right. They include a clause in your contract that eliminates work slowdown and jurisdictional disputes because they believe that, as professionals, they can discuss and solve any problem while keeping your project on target on time. We'd like to take this opportunity to thank the men and women of the United Brotherhood of Carpenters and Millwrights for building the American dream and saving the American dream. Thank you.
Recently on the Guy James Show on the Head On Radio Network.
If you have tuned into this program by mistake right now, and you are a Republican, a right-wing Republican specifically, before this program is over, I do want to warn you, you're going to think that I'm the devil. You're going to think I've got horns and a red cape because I hate the Bush administration and everything they stand for. So be warned right away, okay? You're all warned right now that that's where we're coming from today.
Don't miss Guy James, weekdays, 3 to 5 Eastern Time, on the Head On Radio Network.
Here's a little test for you. Identify the following water-saving devices around your home. Using water wisely is important, since our growing population puts pressure on this limited resource. Ready? That's water-saving device number 19, your outdoor faucet. Check faucets, sprinklers, and hoses for drips or leaks to save water and money. That's your toothbrush, water-saving device number 54. Turn the faucet off while you brush and save up to 25 gallons a month. It's water-saving device number 11, your water bill. If it's unusually high, you could have a leak. Learn to detect and repair leaks by contacting your water provider. Last clue? That's BeWaterSmart.net, a helpful website full of water-saving tips from the Water Conservation Coalition and your local water provider. There are a number of ways to save water, and they all start with you. Water, use it wisely.
From Washington, more of the Inside Scoop with Mark Levin.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're discussing the Democrats' first 100 hours, hitting the ground running. Is this good for America? Are these the right solutions? Or are they, as my guest says, extreme? My guest is John Cox. He's the former chair of the Republican Party in Cook County, Illinois, which includes the city of Chicago. He is currently running for president of the United States. John Cox, welcome back to the Inside Scoop.
Thanks, Mark. Pleasure to be with you.
Let me ask you about this pay-as-you-go
resolution,
because this is something that, you know, it would seem to be, if you believe, if you're a fiscal conservative, and I'm not even sure that that's the right word anymore. Today I call it fiscally responsible, because so-called conservatives haven't been very fiscally responsible. But if you're fiscally responsible, shouldn't you say that we shouldn't spend money we don't have?
Yeah,
I mean, whether you believe in tax cuts or spending cuts or whatever, shouldn't we at least only spend money we have?
Mark, let's first agree that I will, as President of the United States, never sign a budget that's not balanced.
Okay.
I run my businesses at a profit, and it's absolutely horrendous to me that we have a government that runs up huge deficits and debt. So let's start off with that premise right off the get-go. The trouble with PAYGO as the Democrats passed it, and the Democrats defined it here in the 100 hours, and it's not going to have that impact, and it's going to contribute to an economy that doesn't grow as much as it should. And let me explain why. What they're going to define as a tax cut under this is done using something called static scoring. All the way along, the Democrats have fought any effort to go to something called dynamic scoring. And for your listeners, let me explain what this means. That means that when you add up what a tax cut does to the federal revenues, the Congressional Budget Office under static scoring says, oh, gee, okay, we're going to cut tax rates by 10%. That means that because last year national income was X dollars, that means you apply 10% to that. That means the tax revenue is going to go down. It assumes that, in other words, that a tax cut has no impact upon economic activity. That's, excuse the expression, insanity. Clearly, if you change tax rates, you will have an impact on economic activity. And why? Because when you reduce tax rates, you encourage people to make more money. You encourage people to invest in riskier enterprises that have the chance of making more money, and because you're increasing the reward, the after-tax reward. And that's why you get a bigger tax return.
John, let me tell you my problem with dynamic scoring, okay?
Right.
My problem with dynamic scoring is it's exactly the kind of thing that's often used by politicians to fix the books. The Congressional Budget Office, as you know, is a nonpartisan group of accountants. Okay, they're bean counters. They don't work for the Democrats. They don't work for the Republicans.
Okay.
They simply give their best estimate of how much a program will cost or how much a tax cut will cost. They're not perfect, but they're trying to be fair. Every time you do dynamic scoring, and I've seen it in, frankly, all presidents of the United States, Democratic and Republican, it's been worse under the Republicans, you have these magic numbers, stupid things like, oh, if you cut taxes, you'll actually get more tax revenue, things like the Laffer curve, which is a laugh.
Mark, it's financial history. It's, if you just go back.
Never happened. Every time we've cut tax rates, taxes have gone down, except for when it was like at 90% under World War II. But in the last 50 years, it's always gone down.
Mark, John F. Kennedy cut tax rates.
From 70 to 50%.
Yeah, and revenue soared.
Let's talk about Ronald Reagan and George Bush. When they cut tax rates.
Mark, let me give you the facts. The facts are, in 1980, when the tax rates were 70% on unearned income and 50% on earned income, okay, tax revenues were $500 billion to the government, the annual tax revenue from the income tax. At the end of the decade, in 1990, tax revenues had doubled. That's
of course, because Reagan raised taxes in 83, 84, 85, and most particularly in 86, which we praised.
But he cut them.
Reagan undid his tax cuts of 82.
No,
why is it when George W. Bush cut taxes?
Yes.
Rates went way down so much that even the CBO, again, these are the nonpartisan bean counters, tell us we have a systemic deficit. This isn't a short-term deficit, but we will never crawl out of deficit under Bush's tax cuts.
We
Why do they say that?
We have a systemic deficit because of massive spending, particularly the entitlements, but we have a massive deficit because of the spending. That's what's systemic.
Well, no, wait, hold on. You say because of entitlement. That's unfair. We have a Social Security surplus, as you know. That's paying for the entitlements. It's you folks that are taking money out of our Social Security and paying it for people that are making a lot of money. That's where the money's going.
Tax revenues in 2006, letting you catch a breath, were up 14% year over year. The largest increase in tax revenues, I believe, in the last 50 years, if not history of the country. This year, they're expected to be up another 10%. In an economy that's...
And yet, under Bill Clinton, we had these massive surpluses, and right now we have the largest deficits in American history. So it has nothing to do with George Bush's tax cuts.
Clinton had massive surpluses because of a booming economy and because of a massive reduction in defense spending, which you can argue...
That's right. There's no question. Listen, I will agree with you that it's not just the tax cuts, all right? It's the tax cuts. It's the war in Iraq. It's mismanaging the economy. It's throwing hundreds of billions of dollars away on not just Iraq, but oil companies and all the other people that gave money to the Republican Party. I realize it's not just tax cuts, but here's the problem. Whenever you have dynamic scoring, whenever you let the president fix the books and guess at how the economy is going to be, every president I've ever heard of, and again, I'm not just talking about Republicans. Certainly George Bush has done this. Each president magically says, you know what? At the end of my term in 8 years, we're going to have a balanced budget. They draw the line so it ends in zero, and then they go deep, deep, deep into debt. And when it doesn't end in zero 8 years later, they say, oops, my dynamic scoring was wrong. The nice thing about the CBO is it is, pardon the word, conservative, something that the Democrats are being these days. It's not going to bet the farm on hopes for the future.
Well,
it's going to say this is our best guess. And shouldn't we, with all these deficits, be a little conservative so we don't pass on this debt to our kids?
Absolutely. But the issue is PAYGO going to do that? And PAYGO will basically rule out any tax cuts. It'll also result in the reinstatement of the old tax rates on dividends and capital gains that have ignited investment growth in this country. And they will also result in a raising of tax rates back to the 39% level that existed under Clinton. And,
sure. Well, let me ask you this, because I want to get into other issues. But on the issue of taxes, why do you feel that the richest in our country should pay less and the poorest in our country should pay more? Let me just ask you that.
Here's a big idea for you, Mark. Let's throw out the entire tax code. Let's get rid of...
Okay. We'll have to bring the troops immediately home from Iraq. You don't mind that, do you?
Let me finish, please. Okay. You asked me to be on your show to say what I wanted to believe in, okay? So... you can respond after I say, okay? But I believe we ought to go to a fair tax. We ought to go to the retail sales tax. We ought to throw out the Internal Revenue Code, which costs $250 billion to comply with, which is, which regularly has the rich moving their income away from it and hiring, you know, expensive tax lawyers and accountants. It's riddled with loopholes. I agree with you. I don't want subsidies for the oil industry or the pharmaceuticals or the trial lawyers or anybody out there. I want a level playing field for everybody to play in, and I want to remove this albatross from the U.S. economy.
Okay, well, here's my question.
It's a fair tax.
Why is it that every single time I ever have a Republican on this show, every time I hear President Bush, every time I hear any Republican tax plan, it always involves, without fail, something that makes the rich pay less in taxes and makes the poor pay more in taxes? Why do you feel that poor working Americans, who you don't believe should even get a minimum wage increase, should pay more taxes and have a heavier tax burden than they do now, and the middle class should have a heavier tax burden? Why?
Did I just say that? Excuse me. Can somebody repeat
that? Sure you did.
I didn't.
That's what a flat tax does. You know that.
Pay more. I don't expect the rich to pay less or the poor to pay more. I absolutely do not.
That's what a flat tax does.
No,
that's the definition of a flat tax.
It doesn't. As a matter of fact, a retail sales tax, a fair tax, because it has generous exemptions for the poor, it has a prebate, okay? Every poor person would get, everybody who's under income of $30,000 for a family of two would get all of their taxes rebated to them and would not, by the way, be paying any payroll tax either. The payroll tax goes away, and I'm sure you would agree that the payroll tax disproportionately hits the poor.
I certainly do. And, in fact, one of the things that I don't understand why Republicans are against is allowing the payroll tax to go for all incomes and not just poor people.
The fair tax, Mark, gets rid of the IRS, gets rid of the payroll tax, puts in place a retail sales tax so that a wealthy guy who spends a lot of money and buys a yacht and buys a $5 million house or buys a Bentley is going to pay a lot of tax.
Here's an idea, John, and then I want to get to the other parts of the 100 Hours agenda. But here's an idea. Instead of taxing people buying food, why don't we simply tax wealth? Tax the people that aren't working for a living. Instead of taxing income, tax people that've got huge dividends and investments and don't have to work and sit on their bums all day long and collect coupons. Why don't we tax interest and dividends instead of taxing hardworking people?
If you tax capital, you get less of it, Mark. That's why people who are employees have to have employers. You know, that's a basic rule of economics. You don't
see, in my view, labor is more important than capital. In my view, individual human workers are more important than an interest rate on a multi-million dollar bank account. But we disagree on that, and that's what the debate's all about.
Capital.
I want to give our listeners a chance to call in. The toll-free number is 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. There's a lot more to discuss in the first 100 hours of the Democratic Congress. We'll be right back with more of our fiery debate right after this.
Sweetie, I love you, but those jeans have got to go.
Yeah, I know. Grab me a pair next time you go to the store, would you?
No.
Uh-huh.
I'm not going there anymore. I can't stand it.
What do you mean?
It's just awful, honey. The only smile in that building is that big yellow face. Everybody else looks miserable, and I can't find anything there that's made in our country that bothers me.
Well, nobody makes clothes in America anymore.
Au contraire, mi amigo. There's a ton of American-made clothing at No Sweat.
Well, where's this No Sweat store? Out at the mall?
No, silly. I found them at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. There's a link there. I already ordered some great workout gear, and I also got you some new jeans. They'll be here in a couple of days. Surprise.
HeadOnRadioNetwork.com?
Uh-huh. Just click on the No Sweat banner. You're right there. Helps union workers and helps support America's other liberal network. Cool, huh?
I knew listening to the horn was a good idea.
Whose idea?
Your idea, dear. All the good ones are.
Union made? No sweat. Great prices? No sweat. Great looks? No sweat. No sweat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com. Click the banner. Do the right thing.
What's a conversation like on Head On with Bob Kincaid? This is what it's like.
Let's go. Let's talk to our good friend Phil down in Daytona Beach, Florida. Hey, Phil, welcome to the program. Good to hear from you.
Thanks, Bob. Good to hear you, too. I want to remind people that the military take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. And when people say they're fighting for our freedom by defending the Constitution, which defines our freedoms and supposedly is there to protect them, that's what it really means. Not doing whatever this outrageous civilian leadership dictates that it does.
Head On with Bob Kincaid. Conversation at its finest. Weeknights, Monday through Friday, 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Only at Head On Radio Network and chat at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com.
Hi, this is Sarah Jessica Parker. It's hard to believe that 1.5 million people in New York City are at risk of going hungry. More than half of them are children and the elderly. The Food Bank for New York City provides the food that soup kitchens, food pantries, and shelters use to feed those in need. Now more than ever, we need your help in the fight against hunger. For more information, visit the Food Bank at www.foodbanknyc.org.
From Washington, back to the Inside Scoop with Mark Levine.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. We're discussing the first 100 hours of the Republican Congress. You can discuss it, too, by calling in at 888-488-MARK, 888-488-6275. Or you can comment on the blog at RadioInsideScoop.com. I have, I don't know, 20, 25 comments already. I'm going to read just a few of them. Sean writes, John Cox, good luck arguing against these softball items. Wait till they start to uncover some of the really ugly stuff from hearings and investigations. Boy, howdy, you will know what extreme really is. I agree with all these items, though. I would like to see campaign finance reform put on the table, but I'm willing to wait and see, as they say. This is just the first month of a two-year reign, after all. Lenny writes, and Lenny's Republican, of course the plan is going to be dressed up in the most innocuous terms possible, so its backers can say with a straight face, who can possibly be against that? But as always, the devil's in the details, and rest assured, not many of those details will find their way into Mr. Levine's, if it's left, it's good universe. Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Lenny. Lenny, that's why I have John Cox on the air, former chair of the Republican Party in Chicago, a current candidate for president of the United States, to say what in those details are wrong. John, I want to move on off taxes and go to another provision, and that is implementing the 9/11 Commission recommendations on Homeland Security. Do you have any problem with that?
No, but what I do want to do, Mark, is let's establish some ground rules. I think one of the reasons that people turn off of politics these days is because they don't let people get a word in edgewise on a lot of these shows. So let's establish a ground rule that you'll give me an opportunity to respond to something you say, and I'll give you a chance to respond to something I say, and maybe we'll achieve some progress then. Let's
fair enough, but we just have to avoid a little bit of filibustering because we got a lot of this stuff to cover.
Well, let's take that on both sides. Let's have you stop the filibustering on the left, and I'll stop it on the right.
We'll try to do short answers.
Let's do short answers. Well, as much as possible.
If we can.
The
9/11 recommendations. What do you think about those?
Recommendations. I believe, obviously, we have to protect this country. I believe it's much smarter to use our limited resources to go after the conspiracies. The idea that the 9/11 commission had about inspecting, for example, every container that comes into this country, to me is an exercise in futility, first of all, and secondly is a huge public relations thing, much like what it is when we go through the airport. The idea that we're going to hire on thousands of federal inspectors to just blanket every one of our ports and basically bring our economy, in one sense, to a screeching halt, inspecting every single container, doesn't make a lot of sense to me. To me, what we should do is use our resources to interrupt the financial networks of these terrorists, to infiltrate their organizations. We could train literally thousands of Arabic-speaking intelligence officers to infiltrate these conspiracies. Yes, we should try to infiltrate their phone conversations, their bank accounts, their financial transactions. To me, if you're going to try to find a needle in a haystack, you could do two things. You could try to inspect everything that goes on in the country, or you could go and try to find the people that make and place the needles, and I think the latter.
John, I don't see that as an either-or kind of thing. I mean, for example,
well,
as far as the 9/11 recommendations are concerned, of course, the Republicans had them for 3 years, sat on them, a whole number of things, things like buying up loose nukes in the former Soviet Union. I worked on a bill. I worked on the Homeland Security Committee of the House as a lawyer for the House, and the bill would have bought up former loose nukes in the Soviet Union. You'd think that would be something we could get the president behind. He wouldn't support it. Another thing, we were in airplanes. It's not just that they do check your shoes and they do check your baggage, but what they don't check is huge mail drops underneath the plane. We were very concerned about that. The president did nothing. Our nuclear and chemical plants in America, we're very afraid. We're still afraid, although if this bill passes, it will help harden those targets, that someone will take a Timothy McVeigh-like truck bomb and blow up those things. And yes, our ports in cargoes, we do need a way to check them. Not necessarily to check every single one, but to have a way in place to at least randomly have a chance of checking every single one so we can stop these things. And it's amazing to me that you say, well, we need more Arabic translators, things like that. This is the government that has been firing our best and our brightest Arabic translators because they're gay and taking hundreds of billions of dollars and throwing it away in Iraq instead of going after Al-Qaeda. Okay. So it's just interesting to me that you would propose that instead of Homeland Security. Why can't we do both? Homeland Security and infiltration.
We don't have an unlimited source of money. That's why. You can only take so much out of the economy before you start to see jobs dry up, innovation and creativity. We're already losing ground to the Indians and the Chinese in terms of our economic growth. So you know, there is not an unlimited source of money here.
I agree. Let's talk about money. All right. The war in Iraq has cost $300 billion so far. It's likely to cost $500 billion easily before it ends, even if the Democrats end it this year. And yet this bill that I'm talking about, this massive Homeland Security bill that we wanted to do in 2002, cost $40 billion. Now, that's not pocket change. That's a lot of money. But it's less than an eighth of the cost of Iraq.
Well, you're not going to get an argument about from me as to the cost of Iraq. I believe that our effort there was good in terms of the invasion. That cost next to nothing and got done in a few days. The big problem that we've had is trying to get that country back up and running, and it's been managed incompetently, in my view. We should be having the Iraqis pay for their reconstruction. They're sitting on an ocean of oil that they're not pumping much of. They're running their oil industry at 30% of its capacity. That means the American taxpayers footing this bill. It also means, by the way, that the people in Iraq are disgusted with their economy, because they are. The unemployment
and the violence as well. Is it time for us to come home from Iraq, you think?
I'm sorry?
Is it time for us to come home from Iraq?
It will when we achieve victory, and we'll achieve victory a lot faster if we devote our resources to getting their oil industry up and running, put their people to work, get them feeling good about the economy, and establish a prosperous democratic ally in that region. I don't think I want 3,000 brave soldiers dying in vain because we are not doing what's necessary to be done. I'd rather.
And I don't want 3,000 dying in vain for Exxon or Mobil. It's amazing to me that if you look at any Republican proposal, anything that helps American oil companies, that's what they support. Anything that doesn't help American oil companies, it isn't what they support. It's just amazing to me that's your focus.
Did I say that I wanted Exxon Mobil to develop the oil? I want the Iraqi.
Who do you think's developing it? It ain't the French.
To develop the oil. I want Iraqi oil companies to be formed to develop this. I don't care if Exxon Mobil does it. I don't care if Schlumberger, which is a French company,
Really? Because Bush cares. Bush has said no to French companies and no to Russian companies, and he's made sure that American companies control the oil supply.
You're on the phone with George Bush. You're on the phone.
I understand that, and I'm glad to hear you separating yourself from him. Let me ask
the Iraqi people to get prosperous. I think the United States, Mark, has to stand for prosperity, and you have to know my background. I started on the south side of Chicago with nothing. My mom was a single mom, and I got the opportunity to be a success in this country because of the freedom and the liberty and the opportunity this country is. That kind of opportunity is what the United States should stand for around the world. And
John Cox, tell me
this war in Iraq, we would also be impressing upon the people of Iran and North Korea that the U.S. is a friend to anyone who promotes prosperity and liberty and financial success.
And if God incarnate were to speak from the mountaintop and say America was great, that would help too. But what's the? I mean, here you say we can win, and you say we can achieve victory.
Yeah.
I'd like for you to define for me what winning and victory is about, and then I'd like for you to tell me if we don't achieve whatever you've defined in 1 year, 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 50 years, when should we leave Iraq? So those are two questions: what is victory, and how long, if we don't achieve it by a certain number of years, should we leave?
I would define victory as certainly some stability in terms of the violence, but I'd also define it as people getting back to work, their oil industry up and running, support for the government being shown in a widespread fashion. And I think that could happen very quickly.
If it doesn't happen in five years, should we leave?
I'm sorry?
If it doesn't happen in five years from now, should we leave?
Of course there's a time frame. It's not a limit that I'm going to set in stone. I think it's a dumb thing to set a deadline like, December 31 or something like that of this year. I think we need to do it when the stability is there and we can all readily see some level of stability.
So President John Cox,
Mark, we have soldiers still in Germany and Japan 60 years after.
I understand that. So I just want to understand what you're saying. If President John Cox is in power and you're in power until 2016, and there's still no cessation of violence, there's still thousands of Americans being killed, there's still no stable economy, then would you say it's time to leave, or would you say give it eight more years?
I would have gotten out way before that because it would be because
so what, 2010?
The policy is failing. I'm not going to continue with a failing policy. I don't think this president should continue with a failing policy, and to put 20,000, I disagree with the surge. I think we ought to, if we're going to put troops, we're not going to put them on the streets of Fallujah with a target on the back. We're going to put them on the oil pipelines and on the oil wells and get that oil pumping so that Iraqis get back to work and stop blowing up each other and Americans.
You know, let me ask you about big oil, because, and I'm not necessarily disagreeing with what you say about Iraq, although I do think it's interesting that you're focusing more on the oil than on the loss of lives, which is also, as you know, very serious, both for Iraqis and Americans. But let me ask you about big oil at home. One of the 100-hour provisions is to roll back the billions and billions of dollars in subsidies that this administration and the Republican Congress gave to big oil. Do you support that part of the 100-hour agenda?
I think we ought to roll back a whole lot of subsidies for the pharmaceutical industry, for the farmers, for a whole lot of people. I think
including oil.
Too many people being subsidized, and it's because special interests and lobbyists like Harry Reid's five children are spending money like crazy in Washington buying politicians.
I agree with you. So you agree oil subsidies should be cut and completely ended.
I think
no more subsidies for big oil. You agree?
Every single subsidy, you're absolutely right. And we ought to allow a level playing field. I think the best thing to do for the oil companies, the best thing to do for the pharmaceutical companies, the best thing to do for manufacturing in America is to get rid of the Internal Revenue Code and also to streamline regulation. We have got such an unbelievable amount of regulatory red tape. And I know, Bob.
Okay, but John, I just don't want you to change the subject on me. Let me get an answer, though. I think you've said this. I just want to get a firm answer. You're saying that you are against any subsidies for big oil or pharmaceutical companies. We agree on this, right?
No, I think it would be a stupid thing to say that, you know, because there's some subsidies out there for wind and solar and other kinds of energies as well. So.
Oh, I support
those.
Like
get rid of all subsidies and put.
Okay, but all subsidies for oil companies, not for. Okay, not for alternative energy. I firmly support subsidies for alternative energy, for solar and such. But you and I can agree with me, no more subsidies for oil companies to produce oil, to make oil, to
oil companies
fossil fuel.
I don't think they deserve subsidies. I don't think they need subsidies. I don't think they want subsidies. What they'd like is to get rid of the Internal Revenue Code. I think they'd like to get a relatively level playing field. I think they'd like to get new sources of supply like ANWR and the Outer Continental Shelf that can be exploited environmentally safely and are a lot safer than barges carrying oil from the Middle East.
So because you agree with me, let me ask you this, because you agree with me that you don't support back the ones that the Bush administration, Republican Congress gave, I'm really glad you support that. I'm glad to hear that. Do you therefore support the Democratic bill to do just that?
Well, again, I don't know what the Democratic bill says, but to the extent that it would say let's get rid of oil subsidies and get rid of and create more of a level playing field, I would agree with that.
Terrific. Let me ask you about something else. You mentioned pharmaceutical companies. One of the major parts of the Democratic 100-hour agenda, in fact, has already been passed. It's H.R. 4, and what it would do is require the government to negotiate prices.
Right.
Actually, it doesn't even require it. It just doesn't prohibit. The last Medicare drug prescription bill prohibits the government from negotiating better prices with pharmaceutical companies. This bill allows the government to negotiate better prices as they do in Canada and throughout Western Europe. Do you support that bill?
One of the reasons that Americans pay so much for pharmaceuticals, Mark, is because the rest of the developed world puts price controls. Canada famously has lower prescription prices. That's not because they grow out of the ground in Canada. It's because the Canadian government tells Pfizer, tells Bristol-Myers Squibb, tells all the major pharmaceutical companies, Abbott Labs, you can sell your drugs in Canada, but you can only charge 50 cents a pill. So what is
And I think that's
do?
Great. Do you agree with me?
No.
I mean, we should have that here in America.
No, I don't, because if you, all pharmaceutical companies have to compete for capital, Mark. It's a very risky business. You can spend $500 million on a drug and come up with a dry hole, which means no revenue, okay?
So, John, why are American taxpayers...
Will you let me finish a second?
No, I understand that they need the money to do research. I understand your argument. My question is, why are Americans subsidizing Canadians?
Mark, my wife has rheumatoid arthritis. I am happy that Abbott Labs has found Humira and has made her life and the lives of many people, including poor people with rheumatoid arthritis, wonderful because of Humira.
That but is it fair that your wife pays three times the cost of Humira the Canadians do?
What's that?
Is that fair? I mean, in Toronto, there's another woman, and she's getting the same Humira for one-third the cost that your wife pays. Your wife is subsidizing the Canadian.
Fair.
Is that fair?
That's not fair. The people in Canada should pay a fair price, and if they did, then the U.S., my wife would pay a lower price. And see, that's the point. Canada, Germany, Japan, Italy, France, they all put price controls on drugs.
That's right, but we can't control Japan, Germany, Italy, and France.
Yeah.
They are all negotiating better prices for their people. Why is it that we have to foot the bill for them?
Because if we don't, we'll never get these drugs because they take a lot of money and research to develop. You understand this? And if you kill the profitability of the pharmaceutical business, they're only going to find the sure things. They're only going to find the Viagras. They're not going to go after a cure for something like rheumatoid arthritis, which afflicts a relatively smaller number of people, and our quality of life will suffer. Wouldn't it be better for these other countries to do what's fair?
You know, I mean, it'd be better if we could all stand and hold hands and sing Kumbaya, and the Shiites and the Sunnis would get along, but we can't control the policies of Canada, France, Italy, Japan, unless you want to invade them all, too.
The problem is that our
pharmaceutical companies, now let me finish this one, and I'll let you finish. Our pharmaceutical companies are spending more on advertising than they are on research. I don't think rheumatoid arthritis is that rare, but if you do have a rare disease, and there are, then we have things like the National Institute of Health, we have research grants to colleges, we have ways to fund these kinds of things. But with our pharmaceutical companies making massive, massive profits, they're not hurting. Look at Wall Street, they're not hurting at all. They're making massive profits, and American consumers are paying for all of it, while Canadians and the French and the Italians all get cheaper drugs. That's not fair to Americans. I'll give you your say.
Okay. The pharmaceutical companies' return on investment lags major technology companies, which they have to compete with for capital, because pharmaceuticals are a riskier business. Because, as I said, you could spend $500 million testing and developing a drug and have it come up with absolutely no revenue, and that happens all day long. So pharmaceutical companies, yes, do have to make a lot of money because there has to be a big reward for taking that kind of risk, or else investors go somewhere else. What we want, Mark, is we want everybody to feel better, so we want to develop more pharmaceuticals, not less. Having the government of the United States de facto impose price controls with negotiations. Negotiations is a code word, because let's face it, when Medicare Part D, which I absolutely opposed, by the way, again, passed by a Republican Congress that I think was way off base. But because Medicare Part D has Medicare buying 80-90% of the production of some drugs, when you negotiate prices with an 80 or 90% purchaser, Mark, that's price control. That's not a
It is price control. And, John, what I don't understand, and the question you really haven't answered in my view, is why is it fair for American consumers to subsidize consumers all over the globe, unless you can find a way, and I don't think you've named one, for our legislation to force Canada, France, Germany, and England to raise their prices, they're all going to use their governments to help their people get lower prices, while our government doesn't seem to care about the American people. They only care about the pharmaceutical companies. Wouldn't it be nice to have an American government that cared as much about the American people as the Canadian government cared about theirs?
Well, but there's no free lunch. The Canadian government is very happy to put price controls because there are no Canadian-based pharmaceutical companies. They're all based in the United States. So the bottom line is that we do pay a lot more than those other countries. What we should be doing, and this is the real crux of this, what should we do about this problem? Instead of joining them and putting price controls on our drugs, what we ought to do is use our trade power. Germany would never
start a trade war.
I think it's important.
I'd rather just lower everybody's prices.
I don't know if it's a war that's necessary, but Germany would never let us tell them they could only charge $1,000 for a Mercedes, would they?
I also think health care is more basic and more necessary for people to live than a Mercedes. John, we only got a few minutes left. We haven't addressed two other parts of the 100 hours. One is the minimum wage, and the other is cutting student loans. How do you feel about both of those?
Less than 1% of the workforce works for the minimum wage, and most of those, and I know this because I'm an employer, Mark, most of those are teenagers and part-timers who are supplementing their family income.
Okay, but let's play with that statistic, right?
Wait a minute.
First of all, a lot more make up to $7.25, which is what the minimum wage would be, so that's already a lot more. And furthermore, as you know, as an employer, when you bump up the minimum wage, the bottom worker, you got to bump up the guy that's slightly higher than the bottom worker and someone higher than that as well.
This increase, what it's all about is repaying the unions, because a lot of union contracts are tied to getting automatic
terrific.
Increases.
So poor and lower middle-class Americans are going to get a pay increase. You know, at a time when CEOs are making hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars to allow companies to fail, Home Depot is a classic example. At a time when there's absolutely no meritocracy for CEOs, shouldn't we at least give those at the bottom a chance to succeed?
I'm not going to defend Home Depot. I'm a shareholder, and I'm not very happy about a guy getting $200 million in the
you
stock.
Shouldn't be.
He didn't go anywhere. So you're not going to find me defending that. I think more shareholder activism is absolutely necessary. It ought to be the free market.
We agree on that.
It ought not be government, but it ought to be the free market in shareholder activism. But let's get back to the real crux here. What does it do when you raise the minimum wage like that? You contribute to an inflation wage price spiral. And who does that hurt? It hurts the senior citizens of this country. So if you're on a fixed income out there and you're watching the Democrats in Washington get a lot of press and satisfy their union buddies and make it
John, I gotta laugh.
Passionate. Watch inflation, because inflation starts.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. We only got a few minutes left.
They're going to really lose out on that, and that's not the right thing for them.
I really got to laugh here, because it seems to me that when CEOs make money hand over fist, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars, more than they've ever made in any time in American history, no one complains about inflation. When Congress gives itself, pay increase after pay increase, there are no concerns about inflation here. But when the poorest of the poor, the person making $10,000 a year struggling to get by, when that person who may have to take two or three jobs to feed their college, when they want to make a little more, oh, no, we have to worry about inflation. When will Republicans look out for the little guy? Why are they always with the rich?
I'm looking out for the unemployed who are going to lose jobs because of this. That's the other part of this. I mean, you're going to make small businesses basically just cut jobs. And how do I know this? Because Nancy Pelosi was going to exempt a fish cannery in American Samoa from...
No. I mean, we don't have time to deal with that. The short answer is that American Samoa has been exempt for 50 years, and now they're going to throw it in with the... And they should, so that's fine. Let me ask you one last question. We only got a minute left. Cutting student loans, government-subsidized student loans, can we agree that rate should be cut in half for equal opportunity in America?
All you're doing is you're increasing the government subsidy with that, and what you're also doing is you're driving up demand. It's the same thing when you have farm subsidies. If you increase farm subsidies, you're driving up demand and you're forcing people out of business and you're raising prices.
But you know what? Driving up demand for education, driving up demand for equal opportunity, allowing more kids to go to college
people
and not just the people who are sons and daughters of the richest in America go to college, I don't mind increasing that demand. I'm willing to take the risk. I'm even willing to pay for it. Pay as you go, of course. We'll make sure we have the funding for it. I'll take it out of the oil subsidies.
Well,
John, I know we've had a fierce debate. Our time is almost up. I will give you 1 minute, but only 1 minute, because then we have to go uninterrupted. What's the last thing you want to say?
Well, I think you and I can both agree that Washington is for sale. I'm running for the Republican nomination. I'm running for the office of presidency to get statesmanship back in our national life, to get people who are more interested in the country than in making money for themselves. And we could both agree that Democrats and Republicans in Washington have for too long been feeding at the trough, who have not really been looking to the private sector to solve our problems. That's where our problems will get solved, with more competition, more free markets, more individual initiative and personal responsibility. That's what has made a success of my life. I want to make sure that success is available for all Americans, especially those at the bottom of the ladder, because that's where I started, and that's what I'm going to talk about during this campaign.
John, I appreciate your coming on the show and taking. I know it's been a withering debate. I really appreciate it, though. And all I have to say is I think that the private sector can do a number of amazing things.
Yep.
The government can also do a number of amazing things, and if they work together in a partnership, even more amazing things can happen. And I think that the main difference, though, between the Democrats and Republicans is it's Democrats that are looking out for the lower and the middle class. Republicans are definitely looking out for capital. I just like them to look out for working people, too.
You don't have employers. You don't have employees without employers, Mark. So you need to have both work in concert.
In my view, you can't even tell whether you're making $200 million or $400 million. How many yachts can you buy? But that debate will have to be for another day. John Cox, thank you for the spirited debate right here on The Inside Scoop. Tomorrow at 2 is the Week in Review. All topics are valid. We're going to discuss not just the 100 hours, but the plans to maybe get us out of Iraq. We'll tune into The Inside Scoop tomorrow at 2 p.m. This is Mark Levine signing off.
Good evening. Bob will be with us live at about 7 or 7:30, live from Brea College in Kentucky. And until then, we have a show lined up for you until Bob can be with us. Enjoy.